Hello and welcome to the Weekly Defence Podcast, the show about defence procurement and military technology. We are brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Namo. I'm your host, Richard Thomas, and in the news this week, it has emerged that Norway has become the first country in the world to receive the Vehicle Reconnaissance System variant of the Black Hornet Nano UAV. The Norwegian Defence Research Establishment is now testing and evaluating the VRS, which is designed to equip armoured vehicles with a self-contained surveillance and reconnaissance system. The controls are integrated within the vehicle, and the UAVs, which have been developed by FLIR Systems, are operated from inside the vehicle to deliver real-time situational awareness. Now, our story doesn't state what platform it will be integrated into, but I think it was back in 2016 that it was reported that BAE Systems Hägglunds was looking to introduce the Black Hornet into the CV-90 AFV, which is, of course, operated by Norway under its 360 battlefield concept, so perhaps that's a possibility. Looking ahead to the annual Victory Day parade in Moscow, which is still expected to go ahead despite COVID-19, one piece of new equipment likely to be on display is the TOS-2 Tosochka MLRS. Compared with the earlier version, the new MLRS includes an improved fire control system, as well as an increased maximum firing range. According to the blueprints in the patent, the TOS-2 can be mounted on a Tornado U-wheeled chassis. Elsewhere, the German MOD has not concluded discussions on its Tornado replacement acquisition as the COVID-19 crisis continues. This is despite a report that a mixed fleet buy of 90 Eurofighter Typhoon, 30 FA-18 Super Hornet and 15 EA-18G Growler combat aircraft will likely be approved. Elsewhere, in Israel, technology originally developed by SafeShoot to prevent friendly fire incidents among ground troops has been modified and extended to include helicopter pilots and UCAV operators. Green Shield uses sensor fusion to measure the position and weapon direction of connected devices. A wireless network exchanges data between Green Shield-equipped devices to alert shooters when there is a high risk of friendly fire in an effort to prevent a potential blue-on-blue incident. In the naval domain, four US Navy littoral combat ships, two each from the Freedom and Independence classes, will more than likely be taken out of service by the end of March 2021, including USS Coronado, which would have been in commission for less than 7 years. This is an extremely short period of time for a Navy ship to have been in service with, and again, thanks to naval journalist Richard Scott for his Twitter follow-up on this, possibly only beaten in modern times by the UK Upholder-class SSKs. Of note, HMS Unicorn was paid off in 1994 for sale to Canada, off less than a year in RN service. Meanwhile, the EU's Operation Irini has officially been stood up in replacement of Operation Sophia in the Mediterranean, which we talked about in an earlier podcast. It's not known what naval assets Irini will be able to field in enforcing the arms embargo on Libya. Even if assets were switched straight to Irini from Sophia, the latter operation had no surface-based platforms for much of its final mandated period of operations. And of course, it's difficult to enforce a maritime embargo without surface ships. But if I hear any developments, I'll be sure to let our listeners and readers know. So to discuss this and more, I am joined by land reporter Flavia Camargas-Pereira and news editor Ben Vogel.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Ben, I believe you've got some questions for me on the naval side.
Indeed, yes. As you mentioned in your introduction, Richard, the news has emerged about the four US Navy LCS being retired from service, potentially in March 2021. And as you mentioned, this seems like a rather strange decision as these four vessels are relatively new in service. It's not like they're very old ships that are being withdrawn after decades of use. So I'm just wondering what you think the factors are that motivate this decision.
Well, the likely decision to remove these four vessels from US Navy service is basically as a result of the perceived expense in modernizing them to a standard similar to their newer sister ships. These vessels, of course, were the first of the LCSs to be built and enter service, and they've been used in recent months and years as test platforms by the US Navy. So I guess at this point, the US Navy thinks that they've served their purpose. The tests have been done, obviously shock trials and things like that, and now is as good a time as any to remove them from service. In doing so, that also removes a little bit of cost in terms of maintenance and sustainment for the US Navy. And of course, the service is a little bit strapped for cash as it's had to make some difficult decisions in the recent presidential budget request.
And it appears that these four vessels, they're not going to be sold overseas in some kind of foreign military sale deal. Is there any public explanation as to why that is, or do we just not know?
Well, I guess we just don't know. It's in an ideal world, you're going to get the who, what, when, why, when, and how, and everything when posing questions to services, to the DoD, to whoever. At the moment, we have the what is happening, that they'll be decommissioned and held in reserve. Why that's going to happen, obviously the Navy have their reasons, but they're not willing to go public on that.
And in your opinion, do you think the Navy was overambitious in its original planning for 52 LCS?
That's a difficult question. I mean, don't forget that these vessels have been in development for a number of years, and during the time period of the design and development and build of these vessels, the switch of the US Navy, but also the US military posture, has gone from counterinsurgency, gone from, say, sustained periods of lower end warfare and a focus on literal operations, to an environment now where the US Navy thinks, and I've been happy to say this many times on the record, that it is basically a period of great power competition. The perception is that the LCS aren't able to operate in a contested environment. But again, that's I guess that's simply due to the fact they were built and developed for different reasons. So it's difficult to say whether they were overambitious in the original plan for 52 ships. They clearly had a need for them then, and they clearly see a need for them now, because they're going to maintain a fleet of over 30.
Okay, yes, and the current plan, I believe, is to field 31 LCS split between the East and West Coasts. Given what the Navy has learned over the years about the various capabilities of LCS, what are they doing to maximise the capabilities of these particular vessels?
Well, the Naval Strike Missile has been integrated onto the Independence class, hasn't it? So that adds a good medium-range anti-ship missile capability for the class. Adds a little bit more kinetic firepower for that variant, I should say, which will make it, I guess, more capable in operations in the Asia-Pacific region. The capabilities of these vessels are very much based around the mission modules that are developed for them. For example, the mine countermeasure mission module is being developed, is a little bit late, of course, but it will be integrated to the LCS to effectively provide that mine countermeasure capability once the Avenger class MCM vessels leave service.
Okay, and while the LCS program proceeds and plans change and evolve, the US Navy is also planning to introduce a new guided missile frigate. But as I understand it, Richard, there have also been one or two problems with this program as well.
I think not necessarily problems with this program. So this is all based around a GAO report that came out late last week, stating that the FFGX could suffer the same sustainment cost overruns during the service lifetime of the type as has been found for previous classes of vessels in service with the US Navy. So the report outlined what it called severe weaknesses in how the US Navy developed ship sustainment requirements during the acquisition process, resulting in, you know, tens and tens and tens of billions of additional maintenance costs for the fleet throughout the lifetime of those ships. One of the issues that was highlighted during the reporting process, well, it found that there were 150 examples of what the GAO called systematic maintenance problems in failing to identify, evaluate, or mitigate sustainment risks during the acquisition process. And interestingly, the GAO report found that the US Navy did not state how reliable mission-critical systems should be prior to the acquisition process. So listen, I had a chat with Shelby Oakley, GAO director. So a very interesting comment that we got that, and I quote, "The FFGX program is not abiding by existing guidance. Further, for example, the program has yet to appoint a full-time product support manager, which was described as a key initiative developed in 2009 to improve the consideration of sustainment. Further, it was found that the program developed a very poor sustainment requirements that will not improve the sustainment of this ship." Now, obviously, I mean, this is this is a bad news story for the FFGX program, but it doesn't necessarily reflect bad news story for the designs being put forward. Of course, we won't know which design will be chosen until later this year. All the designs are, you know, in service with navies around the world and very capable vessels and operated well. But the sustainment cost overruns, this is the GAO report, continued that the cost overruns fleet-wide affected all sort of ship, submarine, aircraft carrier programs over the last 10 years. It's interesting because every couple of years or so, we get a GAO report detailing, you know, one US sustainment challenge or another. You might remember in 2018, Beth Maundrell, former Shepherd reporter, reported that that the US Navy's submarine fleet over a 10-year period had lost 10,363 days of operational availability due to overrunning maintenance and idle time. Now, to put it in a little bit of interesting context, that's 28 years of potential operations lost over one decade. So
that's incredible.
There's clearly a problem with US Navy's sustainment practices during the acquisition phase.
So given the scale of the problem and the issue, what's being done to address it?
Well, the GAO has recommended 11 points that it thinks the US Navy could take on board and hopefully integrate into its processes in order to rectify some of these problems. I think one of the most interesting ones is that it basically wants congressional oversight of the US Navy's maintenance estimates in order to improve its processes. So further, this is Oakley saying that maintenance issues add costs and schedule after delivery that is often unaccounted for in ship acquisition estimates. The Navy would benefit from congressional oversight because ultimately it would provide an incentive that should improve the quality of the ships it delivers to the fleet. Thanks, Ben. Thanks for that. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Flavia, you have something on new acquisitions on behalf of the Australian Army. I almost said Navy, then Australian Army.
Yeah, the Australian Army has created an office to manage disruptive technologies. The Robotic and Autonomous System Implementation Coordination Office, it's called RICO, and it has an initial annual budget of $5 million Australian dollars, which means around $3.5 million US dollars. And it was established within the Future Land Warfare Branch of Land Capability Division. And the main proposal of this new office is to accelerate the adoption of disruptive technologies in Australian Army. This office, it will be responsible for coordinating and exploring emerging technologies, and it will develop as well the concepts for the use of these technologies. The RICO will also be responsible for the ethical implementation of the Army's robotic and autonomous system strategies. It will work with alternative power, look for energy opportunities, potential applications of quantum technologies, how quantum technologies could improve the Army readiness. It will work as well with artificial intelligence, machine learning, autonomous leader follower trucks. And now, so it will continue the optionally created combat vehicles program. This just as an additional information, this type of technology is some armies around the world are struggling to develop. This is the case of the U.S. Army. They are trying to develop the optionally manned fight vehicle. They have opened a process to look for technologies that could fit in their requirements. And basically, the industry wasn't able to provide what they expect. They decide to cancel this process, and they reopen to try to find this technology. And Australian Army began to develop this technology, and this new office will continue this process. RICO as well looks forward to improve the soldiers' performance. They will develop technologies to allow the troops and the soldiers to make better decisions. They will look for new technologies to provide increased operation efficiency efficiency, and also greater force protection. To highlight, GRECO will build on the work undertaken by the Army since the release of the Robotic and Autonomous System Strategy in October 2018. This office, it will keep working to experiment and to prototype new technologies, and it will continue the work that they are running with national industry and national academy. They'll drive research and collaboration with these external partners. We can speak about the collaborations that demonstrate the notion of the optional crewed combat vehicles, and also the platforms that they develop for the Project Land 121.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of the programs and sort of technology you mentioned there is basically military is looking to create more data points they can use to improve, whether that's platforms or even just a soldier's performance. That's obviously by the use of AI and cloud computing, big data, and all that kind of thing. So it's pretty complex stuff, and hopefully we'll get some more updates as the technology matures and continues. Flavia, thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated. Coming up next, Air Editor Tim Martin speaks to Brian Burridge, CEO of the Royal Aeronautical Society, about UK air power and key RAF acquisitions such as the E7 and the Protector. They also discuss the outlook for the next generation Tempest fighter aircraft programme.
We wanted to take a short break into the podcast to tell you about Shepherd Studio. Studio is our branded content offering, which gives industry a more creative way to tell their stories. Shepherd Studio works closely with companies and event organisers in the aerospace and defence industry to provide bespoke, co-branded solutions, whether it is supporting a particular campaign, content surrounding a major trade show, or bringing Studio on board to more effectively tell a company's story. Studio has already been adopted by many of the major defence primes, including Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and Viasat. If you're interested in learning more about studio projects and how they could benefit your company, please visit us at www.shepherd.studio.
I'm Shepherd Media's our editor, Tim Martin, and I'm thrilled to say that I'm joined by Brian Burridge, Chief Executive of the Royal Aeronautical Society. Brian, it's brilliant to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. Yes, it's good to be able to share my views and those of the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Yeah, I suppose we can't really ignore what's happening around us in the UK and further afield with COVID-19. And I just wanted to first begin by asking you how the Royal Aeronautical Society at a management level has been responding to the crisis and what it's meant really from its members and the professionals within its circle.
Sure. That really requires an answer on two levels, I suppose. The sectors that we represent, aviation and aerospace, are global businesses, and they are actually huge enterprises. And we just think of aviation alone. In 2018, aviation carried 4.4 billion passengers, provided 65.5 million jobs, and represented a gross domestic product of $2.7 trillion. That's a huge enterprise by any chalk. And within that, a third of the world's traded goods were carried by airlines. And the airlines themselves invested $1 trillion in new airplanes since 2009. And there's a global fleet now of 32,000 airplanes servicing 62,000 routes. So a problem like COVID-19 within that is profound. And yes, we learned a lot from SARS and MERS subsequently, but this is altogether on a different magnitude. And indeed, if you go back to 2003, the world since 2003 has become much more connected. China's influence on global economy has expanded fourfold, and their domestic and international airlines likewise. So that's at the top level. And so if you sit below that, then that's going to have a significant impact on the major aerospace manufacturers like Boeing and Airbus and their supply chains. It's going to have an impact on the rest of the ecosystem, such as airports, and particularly we judge regional airports, not only in Europe, but further afield. So this is a profound problem with a lot of jobs at stake. For the UK, given our transitory change leaving the European Union and what we need to achieve in terms of our own prosperity as a trading nation subsequently, then the strategic asset that you need to have is proper joined up communications, amongst which are airlines. So from the point of view of the sectors, this is a big deal. In the society, we have to respond to that. So very rapidly, we reverted to virtual working. We all work from home, and we closed the headquarters, cancelled our or postponed any of the events we had. We had some exciting events coming up, would you believe it? A major conference on urban air mobility was due last week, which would have been really good. And this week there was the application of digital techniques to aircraft design and production, which again, you know, bang up to date, really interesting things for the Royal Aeronautical Society. But life is what it is, and we are trying very hard to maintain as much of our service as possible virtually. And for example, the sort of thing that we can get involved in at the drop of a hat. Sadly, we had Flybe going out of business recently, and we immediately, they were a corporate partner of the Royal Aeronautical Society. And so we contact through social media their workforce of more than 2,000, offer them access to our careers advice service and the jobs bulletin board, et cetera, et cetera. Now, reverting back to the international global level, we're going to see further airline failures or consolidation, but it's a scary place to be right now in terms of jobs. But we're maintaining that aspect. We're maintaining the aspect of accrediting the apprenticeships that we provide endpoint assessment for. We are continuing to conduct registration interviews so that people who've been working for years up to chartered status won't find themselves in a hiatus. And we're just trying to do as much as possible online. We've just published our monthly magazine without difficulty in hard copy, but that's available online as well. But we've configured ourselves in the expectation that this will be a long-term problem.
And what's the society's reading of how this is going to impact the UK defence industry as well? I know you've talked quite a bit about commercial interests, but have you got any kind of understanding of the defence sector and the issues that is impacting some of your members on that side of the fence?
Yeah, it would probably over-dignify it to say my understanding, but I certainly have some views and some analysis based on my day job. First of all, in the immediate future, it is a question of maintaining the capabilities that we have that are important and are at high readiness. By that, the continuous at-sea deterrent. So clearly industry is supporting that and continue to support it. And clearly there's issues around, if you like, the sanctity of the crews to make sure they don't get infected. The same goes for QRA, Quick Readiness Alert, the Typhoon Force, providing the air defence of the United Kingdom. Those things have to go on, and industry will support them. The $64,000 question is the economic impact of COVID-19 on the UK economy and how ultimately that will be addressed by government. And I've just been writing about the Integrated Security, Defence and Foreign Policy Review for the House of Commons Defence Committee's inquiry. And we simply don't know where we're going to end up economically when this problem is over. but we do recognize that public expenditure is probably going to have to change markedly. So I would posit that defense expenditure will be under pressure. In terms of how that looks, then clearly, if governments seek to take a relatively major reset, that does have to be done in a systematic way as part of the review. I think that up to that point, pragmatically, we'll see a slowdown in some of the major programs. We will see, because for two reasons. One is it may prove difficult for industry to meet the deadlines. There may be difficulties in the supply chain because inevitably towards the bottom of the supply chain, we're dealing with relatively small companies, probably finding it difficult to access government support. And the existence of the supply chains in the defence industry in the UK is actually a strategic issue, and in that the original equipment manufacturers invest in their supply chains, they nurture them, and they do regard them as a strategic issue. So if there's fractures there, that will slow down programs. So I think to answer your question, in the near term, there will be a slowdown in programs, and how they're configured will be the determinant of which ones slow down. At the more sort of strategic government investment or MOD investment side, I think clearly people are going to look at programs such as Tempest, Team Tempest, and the prospect for the Future Combat Air System. Although the amount of investment at this stage isn't huge, but the maturation of that project in its technology pathfinder phase will obviously invite larger expenditure. I guess the question mark also is on the timing of successor deterrent, because that is the biggest program or the biggest spike in expenditure in the program currently. So very uncertain for the defence manufacturers at the moment.
Okay, and just I suppose then, if we outline some of the big priorities for the RAF, for example, Protector and E7 and F-35, I suppose those would be the big ones that you would anticipate. As you mentioned, you know, there'll be potentially some delays, and you know, with the economy changing. From your understanding, do you get any sense of within industry how that's happening? And particularly from the MOD side, would they be in discussions at the moment trying to make sure that those big procurements are going to happen as best as possible, given all of those issues that you've just addressed?
Yeah, it's early days probably to for them to get into that. I mean, the MOD is a huge organisation of many moving parts, and it's had to reconfigure itself in much the same way as the society, and the bits of MOD I interact with are still in that transition phase. Also, they have the immediate problem and duty to support the nation in the immediate effects of coronavirus, and you've seen plenty of examples of how the armed forces are doing that with the NHS. But the command and control of that obviously is complex, largely done from main building. So that's a necessary main effort. It is the main effort at the moment. So I don't think the longer term implications on some of these programs has yet been addressed. But it will undoubtedly be the case that the Royal Air Force would put a premium on maintaining the Typhoon force at its readiness level. And having just gone through Project Centurion, then they are very capable airplanes which can sort of hold the ground in air power terms for the immediate future. I mean, F-35 deliveries, the next decision is, so is there going to be a second tranche? If so, how large? That hasn't been made yet. So the F-35 doesn't enter into this in a capability sense too much, in a program sense. Who knows what the impact will be in the United States with aircraft coming off the low-rate production lines.
Yeah, we should say, I guess, for reference, just on the F-35, that the MOD are committed to, through the life cycle of the program, to 138 of the fighter jets, which I think has, I suppose, from a media perspective, there's some critical analysis to suggest that potentially might go askew at some point. It's probably worth mentioning that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you're right in that the language is carefully chosen, and the term commitment has a very small C to it, in that one of the big decisions that the Defence Review will have to address is, given what we now know about fighting in the grey zone, given what we now know of the complexity of having sufficient ISR before you do anything, then there will be a complex rebalancing of the program, I imagine. Certainly that's what I would be looking at if I was in my old job. I mean, F-35 is a superb ISR platform, hoovers up information, presents it very straightforwardly to the pilot. So it's an important part of the force mix, but it's not yet defined how big a part of the force mix it's going to be. So from the point of view of a financial program, you've got some wriggle room there, obviously. On the other programs you mentioned, Protector, it's had a bit of a bumpy ride. I would judge, and this is only my opinion, I would judge that the existing capability with Predator could be run on. It depends, and I have no knowledge of currently the robustness of it in terms of availability, etc. But the one that perhaps represents the biggest capability gap is the E7, because, as I've mentioned, this important requirement to be able to gather ISR, both in terms of electronic intelligence and every other sort of imagery you can think of, is now paramount in modern military operations, and that is a capability gap. I'm not sure where it fits in contractual terms, but I'm sure the Air Force will put high priority on it.
Yeah, and we should say that recently the MOD confirmed a variance in the in-service date for Protector. So it'll be 2023-2024 when that's expected to move out. But I just wanted to maybe get your insight on something like Tempest. You spoke of that before. And I just wonder how the society, what kind of involvement it has on a flagship project like that. Now, I don't want to infer that you have some, specific, cooperation with the MOD on Tempest. I'm not suggesting that, but and for example, a lot of your a lot of people that will be working with the society would be members potentially who are on engineering teams or have some areas of expertise. And considering the ambition here with Tempest, what can you say of it and how the RAS and your members and professionals are working to look at it, or what information can you share on that front?
Yeah, well, if I start from the beginning, the Royal Aeronautical Society is independent, evidence-based and authoritative, and that's our hallmark. We're a learned society and a professional engineering institution, so we guard carefully the nature of our body of knowledge rather than being a lobbying organisation. But because we're a learned society, we were asked early on in the program to work with the MOD on the potential requirement for a future combat air system. and also to give some comment on the way in which global markets might look at that stage. And we have an air power specialist group, and so that consists of a range of people from hugely experienced scientific civil servants right the way through to people like me, ex-commanders in chief.
So, Brian, how technical would that be then? Would there be, you know, looking at RFIR signatures of the design, perhaps, you know, things that are considered to be hugely important when we're talking about a design of a next generation aircraft? And of course, Tempest wants to evolve with remote carriers and combat clouds as well. Are those the type of areas that your members would be looking at, or the MOD have kind of spoken to about and are interested in receiving further information on?
Yeah, I mean, the aspects of signature control and all that sort of thing are highly classified. So, and they would clearly do that in-house, contracted to members of the team Tempest. But we were asked to give views of the sort of strategic rationale, and then some of the capabilities, the way in which we thought capabilities should or will develop in terms of the threat, and should therefore the capabilities that should be developed in company, and obviously stealth connectivity, these sorts of things are vital. And then in our more technical specialist groups, then clearly at that level, there are people tending to work within the industry who are involved. And they will look at generic stuff like signature control and or esoteric aspects like intake design and those sorts of things. But not specifically at the behest of MOD. And the other area, just for completeness, that we have significant interest in is hypersonics, because there's been a significant upsurge in hypersonics across the globe in the last couple of years, with revelations about the Chinese programs, the Russian programs, etc. So, you know, that too is a matter of interest to the Royal Aeronautical Society. And remember, Team Tempest is about creating an understanding of the technologies of a program, which is the Future Combat Air System. And so what is going to be in that system remains to be seen. But we would anticipate, wouldn't we, that there would be something that looks like a sixth-generation fast-jet airplane, which could be optionally manned or unmanned. There are undoubtedly room for uninhabited air systems within that, loyal wingman, swarming UAVs, etc. So it isn't just about a single platform, but all the platforms within that mix I've mentioned are aspects which are of great interest to the Royal Aeronautical Society, and we have expertise in every one.
Did you know that Shepherd Media is fully digital?
Yeah, of course. I've already downloaded the app. I love that I can access high-quality stories anywhere, anytime. That's good for when you're deployed, right?
I actually like that the stories don't waste my time. It's like the editors know what and when I want to read.
And that you don't have to read them. You can watch a video or check out the infographics.
Yeah, it's ace. Did you see that piece on Iran? That piece on the Tor M1 air defense system where the...
Download the free Shepherd News app on the App Store and Google Play, and you can get 3 months half price on Shepherd Premium News for a limited time.
Okay, and as a former fighter pilot yourself, you know, how seismic a change do you think that the move potentially from fifth generation to F-35 to a sixth generation, as Tempest is sometimes referred to as, you know, how much in terms of capabilities do you think there's a revolution at hand here with Tempest, and could you identify the areas or the missions, for example, that will be highly improved, whether that's ISR or EW missions, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I cut my teeth on the Nimrod, so in my DNA is the recognition that the most complex challenge is about information, is about ISR. Now, it's been very interesting of late. You can see significant advantages in technology, in sensors, in the way in which sensors and processing can work, and the way in which integration works so that it's presented in a rational way to the crew. But those are incremental changes. The most transformational change that has taken place of late is the application of artificial intelligence. And we now, again, know quite a lot more about Chinese programs in that respect. And the Chinese recognize that there is this concept called intelligentization of the battle space. And in an era in sixth generation aeroplanes, which can hoover information, we struggled 20 years ago with the fact that 95% of the ISR data we collected was never looked at. And data deluge is still a problem. But with the onset of artificial intelligence, we are beginning to change that significantly. So my first point is sixth generation aeroplanes and a sixth generation force mix, including combat cloud, is all about getting the right information as knowledge in the right place at the right time. And that seemed an insuperable problem in the past. But as I say, now with the advent of artificial intelligence, that's starting to become manageable. So to me, the big change between fifth and sixth generation in the force mix is the presentation of information in complex environments. There is an interesting debate going on too, and I mentioned hypersonics. If you consider hypersonic weapons and their extreme standoff range and difficulty of detection, you can sort of see a paradigm where fifth generation aeroplanes will continue for some time, but with hypersonic weapons. So giving them capability, but not the same capability that you get out of sixth gen either in terms of penetration in what we call anti-access area denial situations, or indeed in terms of their information gathering capability. But nevertheless, that would still be a threat that any nation would have to consider.
Okay. And can you speak about the scale at which the UK is invested in hypersonics and maybe also mention the Rapid Capabilities Office? Because my understanding is that it's primarily that office that are working on that front.
Sure. In terms of hypersonics, at the Royal International Air Tattoo last year, then the MOD announced a program, just a small number of millions in partnership with BAE Systems and Reaction Engines to take a research program forward on hypersonics. It's yet again an interesting British syndrome. Here with Reaction Engines, we have some of the most advanced technology in the world in terms of the pre-cooler that's required for an engine that's going to take you to hypersonic speeds. That pre-cooler has been tested at Mach 5 and works, and so Mach 7 isn't that far away.
Comparatively speaking then, Brian, as well, just to give a kind of balance on that, what kind of speeds would competitors or adversaries be working at? I know Russia as well have been mentioning, and this is from, I go with TASS agency on that, things of Mach 9 they're suggesting, but I mean it's that's unverified, of course. But can you speak about the health of hypersonics and from the UK's point of view? And you mentioned Mach 6. Just how significant would that be with what competitors are doing, do you think?
Well, you just to understand the application of hypersonics to weapons, what you do is launch this thing into a ballistic trajectory. Then it whizzes down to low level and glides down to low level, travels at low level for an extended period, at somewhere around Mach 7. And the issue is it's very hard to detect because obviously it's moving very quickly and curvature of the Earth and all that sort of thing. It's not amenable to standard radar systems. So it is a very potent weapon. So from the point of view of does it need to go at Mach 7 or Mach 9, I'm not an expert here, but, you know, Mach 7 is pretty difficult. Mach 9 is just a little bit more difficult, but they're both outrageously problematic. But I dare say the higher Mach numbers give you greater cruise and glide. But as I say, it's not my specialist subject.
Okay, and maybe if we just round off then with a kind of simpler question, I guess, and maybe just to delve into your experience, because I understand that not only have you been a fighter pilot, but you've also been with, you were previously with Leonardo for a number of years. But in terms of your fighter pilot experience, which was the best aircraft that you flew in and why, really?
As I say, I cut my teeth on the Nimrod, and then gradually as I moved up the ranks in command, I was able to fly a whole load of other aeroplanes, and I flew 29 types from the DC-3 Dakota through to Typhoon. Without a shadow of doubt, Typhoon was the best aeroplane I flew, and I was only there for the birth of the original, the initial Tranche 2 aeroplanes, but... I thought it was a fantastic aeroplane.
Okay, and maybe just finally ask you about then your impressions of aerospace and kind of Earth forces, generally speaking, and the health of the fleets, particularly in the UK, and because we understand that there's going to be a reduction in fighter jets. Do you look upon that with kind of nostalgia and, you know, maybe think that the heyday of the fighter fleet is coming to pass, maybe? Or, you know, how do you look upon all of that?
The comparison between the Gulf War in 1991 and where we are now is stark in that we had, 35 fast jet squadrons in 1991, and now we've got, six or seven. But that belies the fact that one aircraft, like a Typhoon with its Centurion upgrade, is vastly more capable than anything we could have dreamt of in 1991. But one aircraft can only be in one place at one time. And that's the key issue. So, and that's a matter of the UK's defence posture and potentially what comes out of the review, in that air power is undoubtedly the weapon system of choice in a lot of cases where rapid intervention is required. For example, in Syria is a particularly good example where you're trying to stop something happening and stop it quickly. The world is going to keep throwing up those sorts of problems. So you have a really difficult conundrum as a defence planner, particularly in a country the size of the UK, in that you recognise you'll need high-end capability to address those sorts of problems. But now we need to use more space-based data. We need also to be comfortable fighting in the grey space, which requires a different sort of approach to cyber defence and offensive cyber. We need to be able to detect fake news, for example, and react to it. These are all capabilities across now a much broader spectrum. And you would have seen many a defence review talking about the top line is that the UK wants to maintain full spectrum capability. Well, that spectrum's getting bigger. And the ability to maintain sensible depth across that spectrum is really difficult. So, in that respect, there will be some difficult questions coming up in the review. It's hard to see a potential reduction in combat aeroplanes at the moment because they are so well adapted to the problems the world is throwing up.
Okay. Brian, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and hopefully we can catch up in the near future as developments, UK certainly, UK aerospace developments move forward. But for now, thanks so much.
Okay, pleasure.
This episode of the Weekly Defence Podcast was brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Nemo. As always, a big thanks to everyone that took the time in being a part of the episode. And for our listeners, make sure you like and subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and tell a friend or a colleague about the podcast. Until next week, thanks for listening.